Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that does ask, what can your country do for you? My name's Corey Hazelhurst. I'm a partner of propaganda with Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
We are beginning our new series of From the Cradle to the Grave by thinking about how to heal the generational divide. What do the youngsters and the oldsters expect the government to do for them? Is there a generation of those young people we have now that is lost to the Conservatives? Or is there a way the Tories can win them back? And is it through youth groups, Steve?
No.
One interesting thing that's come up through various social attitude surveys over the past year or so is the change in attitudes among a lot of the British public to helping pensioners. So, for instance, in 1996, 69% of people thought that the government should provide a decent standard of living for the elderly. And by 2016, that number's dropped quite dramatically to 52%, so a 17% drop. What do you think explains that?
I think part of it will be just down to the fact that to a certain degree, definitions of what constitutes a decent standing of living have changed. But primarily, it's just the fact that more pensioners have what is considered a decent standard of living. It seems a bit odd, but actually kind of declining numbers in that kind of question on polling normally indicates a less of a focus rather than, you know, a shift in belief that, you know, it's fine for pensioners to be in poverty. If you ask any individual, should anyone live in poverty, chances are they'll say no, unless they're possibly Philip Davies or Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Yes, or Paul Ryan, maybe.
Ryan. But for the most part, people don't hold those sorts of views. Everybody thinks poverty is a bad thing, and everybody would agree that helping people who are in poverty is a good thing. The issue is just that as a certain problem, like, say, let's use pensioner poverty as an example, becomes less and less obvious. Not to say it doesn't still happen, but it's not as bad as it used to be. People's focuses change. So if we were to start to see stories about how old people were now much more likely to be living in poverty, how they were barely able to keep the lights on or eat, you would quickly find those numbers spike up again. Again, that wouldn't necessarily mean beliefs have changed in that regard. It just means the focus has shifted and people are more considering that to be a more important policy area.
So that's basically the idea of public opinion as a thermostat, as some political scientists have said. Mm-hmm. So the idea being that, it's as you say, it's not that people don't care about standard of living of old people. It's more that they think that at the moment, the standard of living of the elderly is fine. And a lot of that is because of stuff the government has done, like free travel, winter fuel allowance, that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Effectively, what people actually hear or read when they're asked that question isn't, you know, do you think pensioners should live in poverty? It's, do you think the government should be doing more to help pensioners?
There's a different context. So 20 years ago, pensioner poverty was a massive issue, and mm-hmm. that's one of the reasons why New Labour put a lot of money into it. I think especially politically, it was the 50p pension rise was one of the things that hit Labour politically in its first year in office. And there was that famous example of the pensioner who wrote a cheque to the government for its 50 pence and the government ended up cashing it. But what is an issue is the social care crisis, which that figure seems to ignore. And it's interesting how somehow maybe pensioners who receive social care don't seem to be part of that group.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a couple of reasons for that, but I think the primary one is that the way we talk about social care is never really in conjunction with pensioners. Yes, pensioners are the ones who tend to get the most use out of social care, but we always tend to talk about it in conjunction with things like health, dementia, or, you know, certain health and medical conditions. So it gets wrapped up in a much wider debate on health policy, I'd say, than actually being concerned with, say, policies surrounding OAPs, even though it should be. So I think if you were to ask the right kind of questions, you would certainly find that people do care about those things. For the most part, the kind of the media and political framing around those issues is one either of, just going off things I've seen for myself, it's either to do with devolution of power, it's either to do with healthcare as a wider thing, it's to do with mental health, which is the thing you will often find a lot of social care discussions in relation to as well.
So note to John Curtis and other people on the British Social Attitude Survey who produced the figures that we're talking about.
And just know so much more about this than I'm teaching them to suck eggs.
Ask the right questions next year.
Clearly.
We can mansplain data collection and polling to John Curtis, can't we?
Yeah, clearly.
Another example maybe of public opinion as a thermostat, which I suppose is talking about what people in Britain want the government to do.
Yep.
An interesting outcome from that British Social Attitude Survey is that 48% think that the government should increase taxes to increase government spending, which is the highest proportion that that has been in decades. And I'm guessing the best way of interpreting that is as a thermostat reaction to austerity, that people think austerity's gone on for too long.
Yeah, I'd say that in that instance, you probably are looking at a very obvious and strong case of correlation between those two. As we're seeing more and more kind of services getting hit by government cuts, you're probably going to see more and more of an increase in people's propensity to back increased taxation as a way to ensure that there is actually funding for various services. And I think if you were to look back at the kind of like the decline of the Tories under Thatcher and Major and the rise of Labour under, say, Kinnock, Smith and Blair, you would probably find that actually there's a similar kind of trend there. The longer the Conservatives go with whilst effectively underfunding services, the more and more likely people are to actually get behind the notion that they actually do need to fund these more effectively, because it just becomes much more obvious when things are failing or that things are failing.
Mm. It's interesting because on the one hand you've got that propensity that as services get cut, there's more people think they need money. On the other hand, what a lot of people, I suppose it's almost like the spirit level argument, you could say, that a lot of government cutbacks, a lot of neoliberalism, because they reduce people's need of the state, what happens then is that people tend to get a bit more individualistic and they tend to lose that sense of social solidarity, because as public institutions get eroded, there's less of a sense of social solidarity. It's going to be interesting how those two factors interplay with each other.
Yeah, that notion of social solidarity is always one of those things that I always find quite interesting and also a bit off-putting, I suppose, in a lot of ways when we talk about politics. There's an awful lot of overplaying of the importance on things like social solidarity on a number of things. I think it basically does boil down to an emotive and emotional story which people can identify with. So yes, there is a certain element of social solidarity behind that, where if, say, the newspapers run a story of somebody who's been killed as a result of waiting times in the NHS, just as an example, you would expect shifts in public opinion in that regard. But for the most part, people are much more influenced by their own personal experiences, more so than anything else. Media helps frame the debate, absolutely, but what the media is saying that is different to what you're personally experiencing, you will go with your personal experiences. And again, that's one of the reasons why an awful lot of the, to take Brexit as an example, an awful lot of the pro kind of immigration kind of sentiment hasn't necessarily kind of transferred over into a pro immigration sentiment on the ground, because we stand there and say, oh yeah, but it's really, really good because it brings in more to the economy, pay more in taxes than they take out in benefits. And you know, that's all true. But the problem is the lived experience of the people in those, say, northern working communities which voted for Leave was they're not seeing any of those benefits. So all they're seeing, actually, for the most part, is a not even an influx, but a noticeable change in the number of foreigners who are living in their communities who are all got jobs. Mm. And, you know, an awful lot of these people who have been living in those communities in their entire lives don't.
I suppose the other thing that happens with that is the phenomenon where people say that their local service is good and is fantastic, and every time they go to a hospital, it's great. But generally nationwide, they think the service is a bit rubbish.
Yeah.
And I suppose it's the experience itself, plus rather than the media narrative that comes out. The other thing that's interesting from the social attitude survey of young and old people is, I think we often think there's a bit of a generational divide, certainly on social liberalism. But the interesting thing is that Britain seems to be becoming a more socially liberal country among all the generations. In many ways now, as we've talked on lots of previous episodes, that the generational divide, it's not so much a generational divide as an educational divide. It's not just a more socially liberal generation is replacing a more socially illiberal generation that's dying out, but those generations themselves are becoming more socially liberal.
Yeah, I mean, there's a kind of wonderful little anecdote I've got about my grandma. Like, towards the end of her life, she was in and out of hospital quite a bit, you know, as a lot of elder people are. At one point, she'd just come out of hospital and just come to see after she'd gotten out. She was telling me about one of the nurses that she had on the ward that she was on. And it was a bloke, which, relatively unusual in and of itself. Effectively, she regaled me with basically how this nurse had come out to her. Okay, it's not even a making a big deal of it, just a casual kind of, oh yeah, my boyfriend type comment. Mm. So which, that was something that, you know, my gran had never really had happen to her before. And it's the sort of thing where, as you know, younger people are much more, say, open about these things than, say, my gran's generation are. They come across more and more of these people as they just, you know, go about their daily lives, which means they get more personal experience with these sorts of individuals. They're quite decent individuals. There's nothing wrong with them. There's no problems with them. They did a very good job looking after me in hospital and all that sort of stuff. Your opinions start to shift over time. And especially when the media narrative also reflects that, it makes complete sense that you will see these changes in opinion on social issues across all of the different strata of society.
Well, quite. So it's not quite our grandparents' generation, but the generation that was born in the 1940s.
Yeah.
In 1983, 53% said there was no problem with premarital sex, whereas in 2016, it was 59% said there was no problem. So of those people born in the 1940s. So there is a more socially liberal attitude. And you can see that amongst all subgroups. And one of the interesting ones is that religious groups as well are becoming more accepting of same-sex marriage and gay mm-hmm. relationships. And a really striking one, actually, take note, Jacob Rees-Mogg, is there's been a 24-point increase in the percentage of Catholics who are fine with gay marriage and gay relationships. So it was 38% in 2012. Just 4 years later, 62%, which is, even if you account for the law of small numbers that this sort of survey has.
It's a statistically significant number. Yeah, it is absolutely fascinating that you see these traditionally very conservative, with a small c, groups adapting and effectively evolving new belief systems as the rest of society is changing around them.
And what's interesting, as I said, is that the divide is not necessarily generational as much as it is with education. So if you look at those people who don't have any formal academic qualifications, the percentage who didn't have a problem with abortion, that basically stayed the same over the last 30 years. It stayed about high 40s, early 50s who think that it's okay for a woman to have an abortion. Whereas in society overall, it's gone from about 49% to 70% over that 30 years. And it's a similar position with same-sex relationships as well, that those people without formal education qualifications tend to be more hostile to the idea of same-sex relationships than most other social groups do. Mm-hmm. You don't see that improvement. We're not going to talk about that much because that's something we've talked about in other podcasts, about that generational divide and what people would like from that.
And you'll find a link to that in the doobly-doo below this.
What we will talk about, though, is how the Tories can try and win over those young people that they have now. In the election, they didn't do a good job of that, basically because they tried to alienate everyone.
Oh, they were very successful at that, actually.
Mm.
Says Theresa May can't be as make a success of things?
It's too soon, honestly. Let's just finish by talking about two attempts that those on the right have done to try and win over young people. Both interesting in different ways. Let's start with the Adam Smith Institute first.
Yeah.
Caveat, of course, I suppose, being that Adam Smith Institute, we don't really know where their funding comes from. It's probably Gollum or the Wizards or something.
Gold.
Possibly communist gold.
That's not democracy.
No. Yes. Yeah. Fascist gold, maybe. Maybe not. A few months ago, the Adam Smith Institute put out their Millennial Manifesto, which was looking at how the right can win over young people who are obsessed with Jeremy Corbyn and Jam.
Yeah, which I think we would both agree. It's worth reading this report for a couple of reasons. One, just because it's written so weirdly that it's actually quite entertaining, but also because it's actually not a bad stab trying to actually work out a plan to engage with young people from a right-wing perspective.
No, quite. So it's written by a chap who's probably about 106 years old and has gem of quotes like, most of them being young people, want to socialise with friends, both in person and in social media, to enjoy music and travel. Many enjoy attending concerts or simply hanging out with their peers over a few drinks.
I would have never known that about my peer group. That is a truly shocking statement.
It's probably best done in a David Attenborough voice, but my impressions don't really go there, sadly. Many young people take recreational drugs. Occasionally, some of them smoke a cannabis spliff with friends. I love the idea of a cannabis spliff.
I also love the idea that should be read in a David Attenborough voice. I think we should make it a campaign that all government and kind of think tank reports should be released in audiobook format, but as read by David Attenborough.
That would be good. I mean, cannabis spliff as well. You either smoke cannabis or you smoke a spliff. Like, cannabis spliff is like Mars chocolate. Or something.
Yeah, the only way it could be a bit worse was if it was a cannabis spliff made of weed.
Maybe wacky backy.
Wacky backy.
That'd be bad. Also, many of them pop an ecstasy tablet to help them enjoy late night dancing at a club. Some of them try amphetamines or snort a line of cocaine.
I mean, it's all factually true.
I suppose there must have been some very awkward conversations with the intern in the Adam Smith Institute office, I imagine.
They just wandered in and found George Osborne in the toilets after a night out. Mm.
So, if you didn't see this report mocked on Twitter, we're going to have to edit that for that, aren't we? If you didn't see this report on Twitter mocked for the stilted language it uses to describe the young folk, you might have seen it reported because one of the recommendations in the report is that airline duty should be scrapped, which is a bit of a dodgy idea, basically because plane travel has very significant negative externalities in that it's going to lead to the boiling of a planet, and therefore we probably should tax it. A lot of headlines were put out by publications saying the right can woo young people back by reducing airline traffic duty, which is not quite
what the report says.
No, so, I mean, the report is looking at things like the cost of living. So it looks partly at the fact that elderly people get quite a few free giveaways, like free bus travel, winter fuel allowance, which young people don't get. Also, public services, free at the point of use, tend to be used by the elderly much more often than youth do, as you've said. Yeah. Elderly people much more likely to use a hospital, for instance.
Yeah, if healthcare is probably one of the biggest examples of you know, what most people would consider to be kind of like public sector use of, you know, that sort of stuff. And absolutely, like, something like, I can't remember the exact statistic, but it's something like 70% of your health expenditure comes in like the last 10% of your life. The older you get, the more time you spend in hospital.
Yeah, well, there's an interesting exhibition at the British Museum which is showing the amount of drugs that someone takes in their life. Not amphetamines, I should note, Adam Smith Institute. These are legal drugs for health purposes. And yeah, the vast majority of them are taken in the final 5 or 10 years of your life. It's interesting if you can see it. Now, there are some silly things in the report. Well, from my left-wing perspective, are a bit silly. So the report buys into the idea of a Laffer curve and says that one of the things that we should do is to lower the tax rate of those who are wealthiest so that they pay for a bigger increase of a bigger proportion of public spending, which I'm not really down with, really. But that's probably a different podcast. They also say that we should get rid of national insurance because they say it's a tax on jobs, which is something that isn't really true. Oh, they also want a free market for universities. So they think that universities should charge different fees for different courses, which isn't really something I thought about. But I suppose if you want to go down the Uber free market approach to universities.
Well, I mean, there's a completely separate kind of topic to have on that, but that's something the government is currently looking at, not in terms of making it a free market and letting the universities decide, but effectively regulating the market to do the exact same thing.
And one of the things it talks about, which I can see happening, especially with the more professionalisation of studentdom, is shorter university courses. So you can do courses in 2 years rather than three, or maybe you do a bachelor's and a master's in 3 years rather than four. But there are some genuinely very interesting policies, and you could probably call them progressive policies as well. One of them that stands out, for instance, when we're looking at fixing the housing market, is having 3-year leases and having longer term leases, which is something that Danny Dorling in his book on the housing market was proposing as well.
If you're not aware of Danny Dorling, just how right-wing is Danny Dorling?
He's about as right-wing as Genghis Khan is left-wing. Also, they talk about an area you talked about earlier, Steve, so investing in mental health, they say, is something that would benefit. Reforming council tax, which is a well, has been needed to be done for probably about 20 years. Legalising drugs is in there, obviously, because of the ASI. And also interesting from our, we need to blow the localist klaxon for this one. They want to deregulate, they want to devolve planning permission down to local councils. Part of it is trying to free up greenbelt land, but it's essentially trying to get local councils to build more housing and doing it at a local level rather than a national level, which I think is something generally we'd probably quite support.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the report, if you're a progressive, you'll read it and go, well, some of these things I definitely don't like. But at the same time, take note, please, Laura Pidcock MP, you could actually see in there a number of policies which you could work together with the Tories to actually achieve.
It'll never happen. So there's that, and it'll be interesting to see the next time the Tories try and write their manifesto in 2 hours without consulting the cabinet, whether any of them end up in a manifesto. So that was, I suppose one could say, a mixed attempt to win over the young people.
Yeah.
Let's talk about an abortive attempt to win over the young people. Can we please talk about Activate, Steve?
So, this is one of those things which, to be quite honest, it wouldn't shock me if some of our listeners had this had slipped by them. It was not so much a newsworthy thing as a kind of political gossip level kind of event.
It was newsworthy on Twitter for politicos, which doesn't really translate as news.
No. But essentially, Activate was an attempt by certain young conservative activists to create a youth movement in the style of Momentum.
Which needs to be done because Conservative Future was disbanded. And,
yeah. Because there is no official youth branch of the Conservatives currently as a result of the tragic death of Elliot Smith, who sadly took his own life after a series of bullying and things which occurred. And effectively, Conservative Future was deemed to be partly responsible for that. And so the Conservative Party just disbanded it. They haven't replaced that with anything else. And as such, Activate kind of sprung up out of nowhere and immediately began to shoot itself in the foot. One of the first things which emerged was they had a WhatsApp group. Within that WhatsApp group, a number of the people in there started discussing about how genociding chavs would be a good thing.
As you will know if you're a regular listener, Steve and I, not massive fans of Momentum particularly, and don't really share a lot of its politics. However, dispatches tried to do an undercover program in Momentum to try and find dirt. Didn't really find a lot that was newsworthy. Activate is out for 5 minutes.
And suddenly they're advocating the genocide of the lower classes.
Yeah.
But, I mean, in the defence of some of the members of Activate, they did actually condemn some of the comments that were made by previous people.
We condemn the gassing of chavs on all sides.
Yeah. And they threw them out of that WhatsApp group, stopped them being involved with the group officially. And then, I don't quite know what happened, but then some kind of Activate civil war occurred, whereby one group of people got control of the Facebook page, the other group of people got control of the Twitter account, and then they just kind of started sniping at each other.
Well, and I think also what happened was they changed the handle of the Twitter account because it was mocked by Guido Fawkes, but they didn't change the account that was embedded on Activate's homepage. So someone else registered the original homepage and was just spamming messages onto Activate's homepage. There was also a meme, wasn't there? Apparently the young people like memes, which if you haven't seen the meme, listeners, is basically like a picture with some words on it. And I'm now mansplaining memes to online marketing manager. And this meme had some sort of lizardly snail character, which apparently is from someone from Star Wars.
Jabba the Hutt?
No, it was Admiral Akbar.
Oh, Admiral Akbar, yes. Yeah, it's a trap.
Yeah, I didn't get the reference, I have to say.
We're going to have to watch Star Wars, aren't we?
Yeah, probably. When we do a film club.
Yeah.
A youth group descending into sectarian bouts probably shows they are trying to emulate the far left in some way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing is, though, and this kind of goes back to the kind of my rather abrupt answer at the start of the podcast where you ask, are youth politics the way to involve young people? No, they're not. And this is exactly why. It's taken to a bit more of a grand scale than you would normally see. But it kind of demonstrates all of the different flaws of kind of like youth politics in all its glory. For us, because essentially what you're seeing here is the very base issue of the fact that if you're a young person and you're involved in politics and a political activist, you are not normal. I don't mean to say that, you know, being involved as a youth activist is a bad thing, but your decision to spend your weekends out delivering leaflets, going off to random church halls in the middle of nowhere because that's where the latest youth conference is.
No, you should be smoking cannabis spliffs and taking ecstasy.
Exactly.
You know, young people do.
You know, most people don't do that. And I say this as somebody who did do that. I was the communications officer and the vice chair for Liberal Youth, as it was back then. I believe it's now called the Young Liberals. Apparently, Liberal Youth had too many Hitler connotations. But the thing with an awful lot of youth political groups or youth politic groups is that the people in them are almost always individuals with very strong opinions, as you would expect, because it's politics. And they, for some reason, it's a bit, in much like student politics, those very strong opinions tend to clash quite fantastically and in a way where if you're not involved with it, it's actually quite entertaining and hilarious to watch. Because what you end up with is just people arguing over things that don't matter at the end of the day. Now, that's not to say that in this instance, you know, the people arguing over a language which is calling for the gassing of all chavs isn't important. You know, standing up to that sort of stuff is very important. But you see an awful lot of policy debates and arguments, and I think arguments is probably the better term rather than debate, which just descend into completely meaningless kind of infighting to the extent where there are members of, like, the Labour Party who will not speak to other members of the Labour Party because of some slight that happened 20 years ago when they were, you know, a part of the youth wing at that point in time. They spend so much time and energy on those sorts of things, and because they're so actively kind of focused on their own ideology, even if they technically have a shared ideology, they don't actually spend any time talking to and listening to young people. So you always find, just as an example, that you'd expect, for instance, that Labour's policies would be more in tune with young people than, say, the Conservatives, and that you'd hold that to be true to a certain extent as well for their youth branches. But the reality is you end up spending so much time in Labour talking about the benefits of different types of socialism rather than actually necessarily, say, campaigning for an MP who's actually going to do some decent work and actually achieve something, or ending up dividing into some kind of sectarian conflict where you couldn't possibly be seen campaigning for this MP because that might actually damage your chance of being elected to this position on this committee within that youth organisation. It just ends up becoming almost a farce. Basically, youth politics groups, in my opinion, are a complete waste of time, energy and oxygen. And I say that as someone who helped run one. I've seen it firsthand.
I didn't get in. I was more involved in the student paper than student politics because I wanted to become a writer, and like everyone who dreams of becoming a writer, it never...
You actually pivoted to audio?
Yeah. But I suppose it's the Henry Kissinger thing, quote, I suppose, as well, that student politics is so vicious because the stakes are so low. Mm. It's people trying to try out politics for the first time, and it becomes a little bit of a microcosm of all the infighting, of all the bitchiness, of all the cliqueness of a lot of Westminster or council machine politics, but on a smaller scale and with more hormones, I suppose.
Yeah, and as I say, all in all, they end up spending so much of their time and energy on those sorts of things rather than stuff that actually matters or makes a difference that you're just like, well, why are you even bothering with this?
Well, I often on the student union elections where the turnout's generally about 3%. Well, Activate's going to launch, I think, in September. On his website at the moment, there are lots and lots of caveats, basically blaming all the ill-informed media speculation for their shambolic showing. Do you think anything will become of it, or is it just is it bolt shot now?
I think Activate's bolt is shot. I don't think they will ever be able to demonstrate themselves as being credible. I mean, that's besides the point, that they're trying to create a momentum campaign without an actual kind of Corbyn figure to rally around. On that regard alone, they're going to be unsuccessful. One of the reasons that most young people don't want to vote Conservative is just down to the Conservative positions and Conservative views on a number of different policy areas. Unless those change, that they're not going to shift.
Well, which is why I think potentially the Adam Smith Institute report is more interesting in the longer term.
Yeah.
Speaking of unpopular, unchanging conservative views, next week's podcast is going to presumably be on the big speech that Theresa May is going to make in Florence on Brexit, because we've not talked about Brexit probably for about 5 or 6 weeks, and you know, we need our Brexit fix where we can just rock silently in a bunker with a bottle of vodka in one hand and an EU flag in another. And if that isn't an image that gets you chomping in a bit for next week's show, I don't know what will. We'll also hopefully have a mini episode out in the week on Brexit coverage and patriotism. We will be having a podcast on a very British coup as soon as we've finished reading it.
As soon as Steve has finished reading it.
That's true. I was trying to sugarcoat that.
It's fine.
Some of us did the prep. What can I say? Our theme tune is Booking Good Times by Dave Depper, and our logo is designed by James Cram. You can follow him on Twitter @James Cram. I'm @Paperback Writer.
I'm @Centre Radical.
Happy plotting.